Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and for many years I did live radio. Then I transitioned to the podcast world where I feel I found my home. I love talking about spiritual formation, justice issues, and spiritual practices. Throw in the Enneagram, movies, and current events from time to time, and that's what you get on the podcast. I'm glad you've come along for the ride. Welcome to Faith Conversations. Welcome to Faith Conversations, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria. Those of you who tune in regularly, you know that, but I realize I rarely say my name, so I thought I would do that today. You're going to be glad that you downloaded the podcast because my guest today is Sho Baraka, and he is a globally recognized recording artist, performer, culture curator, activist, and writer. And we're going to get into a boatload of other things that he does as well. He's an alumnus of Tuskegee University and the University of North Texas. Sho is a co-founder of Fourth District, the AND Campaign, and he's served as an adjunct professor at Wake Forest School of Divinity. I could go on and on. Maybe some of you who are familiar with hip-hop might know him from being an influential part of the influential hip-hop consortium 116 Click. So anyway, going to mention that as well. And welcome to Sho Baraka to Faith Conversations.
Thank you for having me, Anita. We got to shorten that bio up. That's what we got to do.
You've done a lot of stuff. And I've got to say right up front, I feel like out of my element, except that I'm a good conversationalist. So I know this is going to be fun.
I'm sure you know a great deal about hip hop, too. So
yes.
It'll be good. This will be a good conversation.
Yeah, no, I don't. But I have a son and daughter-in-law that are into it.
There we go.
And so that's my knowledge when it comes to hip hop. In fact, my son, I don't know if you've listened to the podcast. It's an NPR podcast, Louder Than a Riot. Do you know
no,
that one?
I haven't. I listen to a lot of NPR. I haven't heard that one.
Okay, so Louder Than a Riot is all about the intersection of hip hop and incarceration.
Mm.
I think you would probably find it a fascinating podcast. Anyway, my son got me going with that. He's listened to the whole thing. There was one season and hoping it'll come back for another season.
That's great. I'm gonna definitely check it out.
Yeah, check that out. My favorite hip hop song, okay, and this may or may not be truly hip hop, but it was Jimmy Needham, a Jimmy Needham song that Trip Lee was a part of.
Yes, I wouldn't say that was hip hop, but
I know.
Close enough. Okay. I love Jimmy Needham, so he's a good guy.
Anyway, love that, and yeah. So there we go. One of the things I learned reading your bio is that you're a Man City fan.
Yes, and this week has been hard on me.
Oh, I bet it has. So my husband has been watching too, because he's a big football fan or soccer, depends on where you come from.
Yeah.
And so he's been watching what's going on this week as well. And I don't know who he's a bigger fan of. I really don't know, but yeah.
So. Oh no! Yeah, it was the biggest game of the year, biggest match of the year. Better yet, and we lost, and it broke my heart. Oh. It broke my heart.
How'd you get to be a big football fan, soccer fan?
My interest in football, soccer, came through as my interest in many things through racism.
Okay, sure. Well, we're gonna get into that today.
Yeah. So I was watching in 2006. I was watching a documentary about racism in soccer, internationally mostly, and. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I were just so fascinated. I was like, I couldn't tell you anything about the sport of, I'm just going to call it football from going on.
Sure. That's just, it's good.
I couldn't tell you anything about the sport of football because I just never had any interest. I was a basketball fan. I played basketball. I was an American football fan. My father played American football professionally. And so I never had any interest in football. So anyway, I'm watching this documentary and, it's 2006, and immediately after the documentary, the World Cup comes on because I guess it was like a promo that was leading into the 2006 World Cup. And so I'm sitting there just like, well, I mean, you know, I'm sitting here on this couch. I don't have anything to do. Might as well watch it. And Brazil was playing somebody. I don't know. It could have been playing the Harlem Globetrotters. But they, like, apparently at this time, Brazil was like the apex of, like, great football. And I'm sitting there watching, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like these, I didn't know you can do this kind of things with a soccer ball. It's like, and so anyway, I end up watching the whole World Cup, like literally the whole World Cup, my wife and I.
Okay.
And after that, I just became a fan. I said, you know what? I've learned that they had leagues. I'd never known that they had leagues outside of, I just thought they played every 4 years and people went to go work as carpenters.
That's great. I love it.
And so I realized they had leagues. And so I was like, oh, this is so crazy. And so I started following the leagues. And ever since then, I just been a fan. It's crazy.
Oh, that's fun. Okay. Well, you mentioned that you grew up a basketball fan. So I was in Chicago for 32 years. I have to ask, who's your favorite NBA team?
Oh, the Lakers. I grew up in Los Angeles. Well, not in Los Angeles, but outside Los Angeles.
Okay. And so
the Los Angeles Lakers. I grew up watching Showtime Lakers.
Oh, yes.
All
right. Good enough. Good enough. I'm a Bulls till my death.
I hear you. And I mean, you know, you had some wonderful years.
Yeah, we had. Hopefully.
I tell you this though, that series, that ESPN series was amazing.
Yes, it was. Yeah. So. We watched it couldn't wait each week when they released it, one at a time. It was cool. Well, one of the things I didn't mention, I need to say this. One of the things I didn't mention at the outset when I introduced you is that you are the author of a new book, and we've got to talk about that. The title of the book is He Saw That It Was Good, Reimagining Your Creative Life to Repair a Broken World. And I want to get into the content of the book, but I want to do it maybe through a back door. I don't know. I want to find out a little bit about your story, as people tuning into Faith Conversations may be unfamiliar with you. I don't know. But I want to hear a little bit about your faith story, and then why you chose to write about reimagining your creative life, because I think that's certainly an important piece of this conversation today.
Yes, I grew up in Southern California, but my father, like I said, my father played professional football for the Saints. And so once he was done playing, our family moved to Southern California. And most of my life, had both parents in the house, but not too long after my father stopped playing ball, he and my mom separated and then eventually got a divorce. So, the household we kind of grew up in was, one of loving parents, but also just kind of dysfunction. So we moved around a lot at points and times. My mom was a part of the Black Panther Party at a young age. So she informed us about, injustices, had us reading all kind of stuff and literature. I don't know, just at a young age, I felt like I carried the burden of blackness.
Yeah.
Way more than any child should ever have to carry it. Especially when I lived in predominantly white areas, when I lived with my father, it was just like, I felt like I was the representation of black identity for these kids. And it's just like, I matured really early, if you will. And what also means is I was very conscious about who I was and who I met in society. And not only around white people, but also when I would move back into black places. And I was, when my mom, who never really had a career, but always worked, living on government assistance. And so you're living in these communities that are, pretty rough or blighted. And so I'm speaking somewhat articulately, and the other black kids are calling me white because it's like, why you talk like that?
Yeah, right.
And so I have these identity conflicts. I'm struggling, I'm wrestling, trying to figure out who I am. And so anyway, eventually time moves on. My father comes back into our lives. He becomes a Christian now. And one of my older brothers becomes a Christian as well. And he was like one of my heroes. And so their faith had this indelible impact on me. It really began to make sense of why people go to church. It wasn't just like, oh, you just do this just because your grandma told you to do it. It's like, I'm actually seeing changes in your behavior. I'm actually seeing you become a nicer person. I'm actually seeing you care for other people. And it softens my heart to this idea of faith and Christianity. When my whole life, not my whole life, but most of my life, when my father wasn't necessarily around, my mother remarried a Muslim or a Nation of Islam Muslim. So I am seeing Christianity as this white man's tool to subjugate black people. And so, and not only that, a lot of black literature and history doesn't look at Christianity favorably, depending on who you're reading. But then I end up going to college. I go to Tuskegee, and that expands my idea not only of just different types of idea that are thinking sociologically, but theologically, but also like different types of Black people. You know, you got Black people from Alaska, Black people from, you know, Florida. It was just all kinds of different, you know, poor Black people, rich, wealthy Black people who come from money, and Black people who are atheists and goths, which I've never even knew was a thing. I was like, I didn't know Black people could be gothic. So, you know, I had this experience and it really shaped my paradigm, but that's also when I came to faith and through a college ministry, through my brother's influence mainly. And so from there, and you feel free to interrupt me at any point.
This is fascinating.
I'm a college student who is going to this Bible study, and because my brother, he said, man, look, I can't make you live life. I can't, but just do one thing for me. Just go to a Bible study. Huh. So I start going to this Bible study.
Okay.
This Bible study shows this promotion for this conference over the winter break called Impact.
Okay.
I end up going to Impact, and the first night, this man, James White, to this day, one of my mentors and kind of just sages in my life, preached a message on called Divine Distinction. It was basically about the crucifixion of Christ, the passion of Christ. And I just remember that night, my life is going to be different after hearing this. I cannot live the same. I lived with a young lady at the time. I had roommates who all wanted to do is party and smoke weed. And I just knew, I was like, I just can't go back to this environment. I have to figure out how to change my life. And ever since then, it's just been this toil of trying to figure out what does it mean to live for the Lord. You know what? I left a very important part out of that.
Yeah.
And so through my parents kind of helping me, giving me literature, telling me to read this, informing me, I fell in love with art. It started off with poetry because my parents used to, you know, like, well, if you're going to read something, read this poem by Langston Hughes or read this by Claude McKay, or read this Maya Angelou. And so poetry became the way that I first initially expressed myself.
Okay.
But very similar to how I get into many other things, girls were the reason why I transitioned to hip hop, because I was like, well, these ladies seem to like hip hop more than rapping, more than poetry. So start rapping. So in high school, I started to rap. And then once I went off to college and became a Christian, I really didn't know what to do with music. I just didn't see any viable lane for rapping. It just didn't. I was like, I don't know. Is there such thing as Christian rap? Do people rap for the Lord? And then my older brother started to hand me music from groups called like the Cross Movement, Tunnel Rats, and Grits. These are groups I'm sure you're familiar with. And you know,
actually, some of them I am. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. See, so you know, Cross Movement were my favorite, and so I just kind of just soaked them up. And that became a way that can begin to inform kind of like the usefulness of music in the lens of how to use it, not only in the evangelical sense, but just a way to just form and shape your identity as a person who loved, who came from this particular culture, and not allowing it to, you know, not having to punt it or to forfeit it and sacrifice it anyway, but submit it unto Jesus, if anything. And so for me, it was like, well, what does it look like to use hip hop as a vehicle for the gospel? And also, what does it look like to just continue to engage and be a part of this community and not necessarily forsake my Jewishness, as Paul would say, you know what I mean? But bring it under submission to the Lord. So
that's the backdrop. That's the history we need to kind of get into. You know, why writing about creativity and reimagining your creative life is so important, but not just that, but in, you know, for repair of a broken world, as the subtitle says. Help us understand hip hop too as a medium. I think that would be helpful to the conversation. What is important about that medium of that message medium, I guess?
So much. So I actually had a chance to teach a class, and I've lectured on hip hop many times about, you know, its ability to transmit political, religious, social ideas. But to first understand hip hop, you have to understand its birth. It's where it come from and where it's come from and how it came to be. And you think about this bubbling up, this burgeoning of a message that came from this frustration of New York City, of the Bronx, that was being, I guess you can say, they were going through a housing crisis where, yeah, you know, the mayor and other individuals were trying to figure out how to marginalize, to suppress, move people around. So you have this housing crisis. You also have these gang, this gang violence that's propping up. And so people are trying to create a solution for these kids who have this angst because there's no jobs, there's the school systems are terrible, and plus the housing and living situations are terrible. People are being displaced because they want to run these, you know, these transportation mediums through these particular communities. And so it's like, there's this angst, there's this political angst, there's this social angst, and people don't know how to communicate their frustration because disco's not doing it, you know?
Yeah.
R&B is doing a little bit of it, but it's not wholly capturing the essence and the zeitgeist of the moment. And so what you have are these people who are very similar to the Christians in the early church, communicating their frustration on the catacombs of their community. So that's graffiti. You have these folks who are using their expression to, rather than fight each other, to battle each other and dance. It's like, well, I have my crew, you get your part of the neighborhood, we'll meet here and we'll battle through dancing. That's how you get b-boying and breakdancing. You have these DJs who were the real stars of hip hop in its early years, who were the folks who would have parties. They would bring their sound systems,
yep,
and they would take these old records and they would find the break beat and they would just spin it over and over again. And this was clearly just an attempt to try to create family and connectivity in a community that was falling apart, that was uprising and trying to figure out, who are we in this world, right? And then eventually what would happen is that, you know, there would be a master of ceremony, which now we know as MC, would get up and just entertain the people in between the DJs mixing and scratching and say, all the party people, how you feeling? You guys doing all right? You know what I'm saying? Hey, somebody left their car key. I mean, the lights on outside. You know what I'm saying? My guy in the back, he got some good ice water. You know, go check him out. You know, just, you know, whatever. So basically, you that's what, and then eventually it turned into battling. So now you had the crews who were just dancing. Now the MCs would battle who has the best MCs, who has the best DJs. And that turned into from the DJ being the front man to the MC being the front man. But really what took it over is this attempt to try to communicate the angst that was bubbling up in the community. And so think about that. Think about the beginning, the start, I can't think of the word, just the birth, the origin
inception,
story,
or, yeah,
inception, that's the word I'm looking for. You think about this inception and its usefulness of that time and how it was this tool to communicate social sensibilities that folks felt were being ignored. 50 years later, 40 something years later, it's the same tool. Yeah. It's the same resource. It's the same thing, not only through movement, not only through art. It's like, hey, I feel like we need to beautify the community in the way that we feel represented. That's street art.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? People want to communicate through dance. It's like, okay, well, this is me and my crew. We're battling. Now it's way more sophisticated. You got to travel the world. But the angst is being communicated through movement, through physical movement. The artists are basically communicating their prophets and griots of their time. They're keeping history. They're keeping track of the history. They're transmitting folklore. This is what our ancestors thought. These are the things that have troubled us. And we're also communicating to people because now it's a bigger platform. So you're now communicating to people who are not necessarily in your district.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're coming forth and you're saying, people of greater Atlanta, people of greater et cetera, here's what these folks on the margin of now. And it's, but to be fair, obviously hip hop is not just relegated to the margins anymore. It's everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a corporation, yeah, used for corporate, you know, marketing. It's all over the place. And yeah, so not only is it now just this political or this voice for political and social benefit, now it's actually creating opportunities for people to better themselves, get jobs. They're empires now. So it's everything from the voice in the corner to the actual building empire in the middle of the city.
So thank you for that backdrop. I feel like I'm going to school here and people listening are too. So I feel it's professor.
Hey, can I say something else real quick?
Yeah, please.
I got to realize that I've been running my mouth for long periods of time and I try to be more.
Oh, this is awesome. I love it.
The other thing that I think hip hop needs to get a lot more credit for is its literary devices, the use of its literary devices, because oftentimes we look at, you know, your Shakespeare's and I'm going to draw a blank, Joyce's, whoever else is out there who get all the praise. The reality of it is hip hop uses those same literary devices, even if they don't know that they're using them. And at some point, I think there needs to be academic, not just academic observations of hip hop through its social benefit and its political benefit, but actually through its literary benefit.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Learn language and communication through hip hop in a way that they probably don't learn in any other medium or modality.
Okay, all right, I appreciate that. I want to know, with the rising up of these various artistic elements that you just talked about, because you talked about dance as well, and all kinds of things. Where was the church in this picture?
Where the church usually is most times is protected its power and its position, trying to figure out how to. The institutions usually there are individuals in the church who obviously. Who fight on the forefront, who are trying to figure out how to be a voice to create opportunity and resources for people. But as a whole, oftentimes the church is a little late to the party.
Out of fear or out of protection or out,
I don't think it's fear. I do think it's, I think it's a couple things.
Yeah.
I think it is a little bit of self-preservation in the sense that they're trying to preserve the holiness of the institution. Which I get, because it's like, you allow any kind of idea and ideologies and philosophies and methods to permeate the church, then we know where that can go. However, I think a lot of it is a little bit of overanalysis and a little bit of I don't want to say apathy, but it's like we don't know what to do, so therefore we're just not going to do anything. And so we'll pray and we'll give these little, let's pray for this and we'll just, but at the end of the day, it's just business as usual.
So talk about then the inception of Christian, overlay this with Christian hip hop. I mean, that's probably not necessarily
okay.
The right way to.
It's okay. It's okay.
You know what I'm talking about.
I get what you're saying.
Okay. When did that enter the picture?
I think very similar to my previous statement about the church maybe being late, but people within the church seeing a usefulness for interacting in society. I think the same thing happened with Christian hip hop. I think. You had people who came to know the Lord, who loved hip hop, who were part of the hip hop community, who authentically connected to this movement and this culture. But then they realized, like, man, I love Jesus. And there are certain aspects of this culture that I'm going to have to, like, separate myself from. Or even the things that I love about this, how do I submit it unto Jesus? Doesn't mean I have to give up dressing the way I have to dress. I can't, I'm going to stop breakdancing. I don't have to necessarily stop street art, but how do I submit these things unto Jesus? And I think what happened is there was no space for them to do it in the church. And so what tends to happen is you either create your own little silos, your own little small movements, and that's how Christian hip hop starts, right? You got people who are like, well, let's just rap in churches. We'll just go around or rap in community centers or rap on corners, or we'll have our own little house parties for people who are like us. We have a tribe. It's just there's no tribe. There's no place for our tribe to go. Like there's no land that we can say this is our plot of territory. It's just like we are orphans. And I talk about that in my book. And so I think what's happened is over time, the church has become a little bit more malleable to this idea of Christian hip hop. They've even though it took a long time, even black church, white church, you know, but coincidentally, I would actually say that white churches probably became more lenient or more accepting of Christian hip hop. Then, and that may have something to do with like the Jesus movement and like Christian rock of the past.
I wondered because that's what I grew up during the Jesus movement. And that was, and I feel in some ways, I don't know if it's equally happy, equally sad. I also feel like I missed out on all kinds of genres of music that were happening in the world because I just moved everything over to the Jesus movement music. And that was, I missed like decades of music because of that. And so I think that's also sort of interesting, but okay. Around the same time though, you think?
Yeah. Well, after time. I think there was a,
maybe like, more like 80s.
Yeah. Right. And so you have individuals who maybe come from these particular movements who see the usefulness of being like engaging to a people who oftentimes are not considered. And so I think now, even though it's still not very prevalent in many churches, it has an institution and a movement that is strong enough, if it wants to live autonomous from being tethered to the church institution itself, if that makes sense. Like very, very similar to how CCM, very similar to how gospel, you need the patronage of the church and the patronage of Christians, but you don't have to be tied to like the Southern Baptist or the Kojic church or, you know, so it can live, it can exist. But the problem is that the players within the movement operate in dysfunction and there's so much disagreement that I don't know if there's a desire to see Christian hip hop flourish and succeed because of the stain it may have, not only to the world, because oftentimes when you put Christian on something, the world already devalues it.
Yes.
Sometimes rightfully so. But I think there's enough influential individuals who can make it something like the world's never seen before.
Where do you put your, I mean, how do you label, and I hate using that term actually, but you know, where does your hip hop artistry fall?
Yeah, it falls. So in a perfect world, it would be considered conscious music. It would be considered conscious hip hop.
Okay.
But I recognize somebody created a Wikipedia page for them. I didn't ask them to, the fans did. And on there, I'm a Christian hip hop artist. Usually when I do interviews on mainstream radio, they introduce me as a Christian hip hop artist.
Okay.
So
that's interesting.
You know, you are what the consumers tell you you are.
Okay. All right. Well, let me ask about message.
Yeah.
You know, you talked earlier about hip hop and the inception of hip hop and, you know, social and political overtones. What about Christian hip hop, if you will? Similar?
No. Christian hip hop is birthed out of a very evangelical posture.
Interesting.
And so it was the more prominent Christian hip hop was a direct opposition is a very violent word, but I will say, to some degree, and direct opposition to some of the main ideas that were being pushed in black communities from like your Nation of Islam or your 5% Nation, or, you know, some of your more, some of your black thinking and religion in epicenters like New York, Philly, Los Angeles, et cetera. And so you have these folks who lived in these areas who became Christian and they're like, well, look, I want to share my idea. I want to share the things that I believe. And so it became more of like, Christians ain't no punk. You know what I'm saying? We love Jesus and we still have a good, you know, so here's our beliefs. Here's our theology. Okay. Here's our perception. And I think over time, it became more political, more social driven. And if I, and I'm just going to say this,
yeah, please,
there are people who, there are other people who've said this. Some people will say I am part of the reason why it's become like that,
okay.
Because I was one of the first to be more political, more socially conscious. Although I know there were people before me, but I think because of my platform at the time,
yeah,
and because of the drastic change that I made, because I was with a label that was very, very, very evangelical, very preachy, doing tours with some of your biggest evangelical leaders.
Okay.
And I said, I need to move away from this to talk about policing. I need to move away from this to talk about race. I need to move away from this to talk about issues in the Black community, not from the posture of preaching at folks, but being more critical in how these are issues that span just this person's laziness and or this person's crack addiction or this person's like there's some issues that are playing into why this person's addicted to crack and why this person can't find a home and why, or there's a reason why this police officer keeps shooting, you know? And mm-hmm. so I started to make those ties and folks were like, man, you know, some folks were like, this is amazing. And some folks are like, you are a heretic. You are preaching that social gospel. You are. Yeah. So, and I got, you know, and this was in 2011, 2012 when I, became like blackballed in a lot of spaces.
Ooh,
so.
Wow. So, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to,
I don't want to make it sound more dark and sinister than it was, but it, you know, it was tough. It was tough, but
absolutely.
I couldn't walk down the street. I was like, oh, there goes that heretic. You know what I'm saying?
No, and I get that, but I think this is a really important conversation because of what has happened culturally. And so I'm going to read a quote. I just happened upon this today. So this is Phil Vischer, and I think you were probably on the Phil Vischer podcast. Might have even, and you were not.
I think Lecrae was on there.
Oh, maybe that's what it. Okay, yeah, so I found this quote, and I love your response to this. I think Vischer said that the church allowed racism to flourish. Now we're mad about secular solutions to a problem we wouldn't solve.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I thought that was a powerful amen. Quote.
Amen, amen, and amen, Phil.
Yeah.
Bob. Yeah. Bob the tomato has a word for us.
Exactly. And so, you know, you moved down the road a piece from what your 2012, what you were just mentioning, mm-hmm. to 2021. Wow, that is that is moving down the road a piece from 2016. You know, so many things have happened in our country, not the least of which is the murder of George Floyd, which really propelled this conversation, I would say, especially in the larger world and probably in the white world, right, to the forefront. And so in the context of all that, let's talk about why it's so important to continue to express ourselves creatively, what that does in the middle of the creative arts, why they're so important, how people hear things differently.
Yes.
In the context of creative mediums, as opposed to just, you know, talking heads.
I think that's beautiful, beautiful question and the position. And I'll start with a little anecdote. I in 2012, I think it was, maybe 2011, I went to an off-Broadway play of Screwtape Letters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was me and maybe like seven of my friends. And we were like one of maybe, or seven to 300, maybe a little bit more people in the audience. And so I forget the dude's name, but Max.
McClain.
Max McClain. Max McClain was the, you know, he was the actor. And so after the play, he does a Q&A with the audience. And he begins to, so I'm familiar with C.S. Lewis's work. I didn't know Max McClain at the time, But I was familiar with C.S. Lewis's work, and he starts to ask questions to the audience, like questions like, how many people are familiar with C.S. Lewis? You know, a large amount of people raise their hands. And then he asks a question like, well, how many people believe in God? And, you know, maybe a little less than half the people raise their hand. And then he's like, how many people believe in the God of C.S. Lewis, like the same God that C.S. Lewis believes in? And even less people raise their hand. And then he starts this conversation, not only with people in the audience, but like this woman who's a radio host. And they just have this really interesting conversation about religion and art. And the whole time I'm there, I'm thinking, I was like, this guy must be a Christian, because he's being really subversive about like the questions he's asking. I was like, this is really interesting. Like, I could just tell from his posture, like he's trying to communicate something. He's getting people to wrestle with questions. And I remember afterwards, we stuck around and we had a conversation with him. And the whole thing, the one point that stuck with me wasn't even necessarily something he said. It was the fact that 70 years after C.S. Lewis's work, in the middle of the most secular place in probably the world, we're having a conversation about religion and God.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying, and how did we do that? Because art.
Yes. Yeah.
Because art. Yeah. And I'm sitting there thinking like, I have to do something different. And that's when I was like, I don't know if the way that I'm presenting my art is the most effective way of doing it. I'm leaving out so many people in the conversation. And so all that to say, and plus, you know, obviously C.S. Lewis was excellent at what he did. So, I mean, you know, you got to be excellent. You got
to
be good.
Right, right. So where did that propel you to then?
So that propelled me to, I think, a place of me recognizing that art doesn't necessarily have to proselytize. It doesn't necessarily have to always answer questions. It doesn't have to be evangelical in its goal. I think what it is, it's a canvas that paints a picture that hopefully tells the truth about society that presents questions. And so what do we think about relationships because of this that I've propositioned? And so now people are sharing, because ultimately, if I were to say relationships is utterly, there's no other way than only communicating relationship through Jesus died for me, and therefore I love him, that's why I married this woman, and et cetera, et cetera. Then it's like, well, people are not going to even engage that. They're like, I'm glad for you, but I'm not. But if I proposition it as, hey, you know, Stevie Wonder's Ribbon in the Sky, people are like, this is a beautiful song. It's a song about commitment. But it's also talking about, he sneaks it in, he says, we can't lose with God on our side. And so somebody could ask, well, Stevie, what do you
mean
by that?
What does that mean? There you go.
You know what I'm saying?
Well,
and now.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, now you have the world of opportunity to now do your evangelical work if you want to.
Well, and I think, you know, pull that picture back. Let's just look at the body of nature that maybe we can enjoy in the world, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's art on its own. It elicits all kinds of questions if we have the curiosity to ask them.
Absolutely. If only we have the curiosity. Yeah. There's another C word. If we have the courage to do it or to paint it, and then the curiosity to ask those questions. I think it's because oftentimes there's incentives for us to be very one-dimensional in our creation.
So I wrote down courage and curiosity. I often will pull the curiosity word out, but I think you have just added that courage word to my vocabulary and made me think, even in the context of issues of justice, mm-hmm. It's one thing to have curiosity and ask questions, but that doesn't happen until you have the courage.
Absolutely.
Piece.
I think courage means a lot in the sense that you have to have the courage to believe that you may be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the courage to engage in work that you
may be hard.
Yes, that may be hard and you've avoided for so long. And then when you know you've arrived at a different place, the courage to actually do and work and to engage. But I think that courage and curiosity goes together. It's just like, cause you can't, if you're just courageous, you go out there and you'll do some courageous stuff, but you'll be doing it stupidly.
Yeah.
So you're courageous while you're asking questions like, hey, how do I help? Well, do I need to shut up right now? Okay, I'll shut up. Well, when do I need to speak? Oh, I'll speak up. Well, how do I, you know, is this even a real issue? Because sometimes I have a quote in a book from Howard Zinn. I think he's got it from somebody else, but he says that every cry from the poor is not always real, but you'll never know true justice until you actually listen to them. And so I think oftentimes what happens is we're forcing people to be courageous, is go out there and just speak out and just do and do and do. And it's like, well, hold up. Sometimes this doesn't require activism. This doesn't require us to rally around. Like, this was dumb. They shouldn't have did that. You know what I'm saying? Or this should have happened. But then there are moments when we have to be curious and be like, well, why? Okay. But the problem is social media is an accelerated our outrage and our anger, and so therefore we feel like in order to be relevant and to be in the in crowd, we have to do things now with Russian anxiety, and I think we need a little bit more wisdom and patience in our work. So, with our courage and our curiosity.
So I hear that about courage and curiosity. What do we do in the midst of that in our churches and in the world when we have some deep divides? How do we keep moving forward? How can, as I'm looking at your book, he saw that it was good, this whole idea of reimagining your creative life to repair a broken world. How does moving forward in that creative life, how is that part of the solution? How does that help us to heal divides even?
Yeah, well,
how,
I think...
How can it?
Yeah, so there are many theologians who've communicated what I'm about to communicate, but I've tried to make it in my own language as I've seen my own reworking of what it means for the redemptive narrative in Scripture and how it applies today, is that we were created to reflect God in all we do and to have a perfect relationship with God. We were created to have perfect relationship with one another, but we were also created to have perfect relationship with our work and how we create and cultivate. Sin inverted that. And so therefore there's a corruption in how we view God, there's a corruption in how we view one another, and it's a corruption in how we work. And if we believe that Jesus is redeeming all things, then he's redeeming our relationship to God, our relationship to other people, and he's redeeming our relationship to how we work. And so people first have to see that that's prevalent in our gospel. And I think if you don't see that, then you'll continue to cultivate and work and contribute to detriment while praising God, thinking you have good relationships with human beings, but creating a mess. Ugh. And I think the church has been complicit in teaching people theology, teaching people to have good relationship with one another, but once they leave the church, they're participating in types of work and vocation that brings detriment to their neighbor.
Yeah.
And so that's how I view creative life. It's not that I'm talking just to artists. It's right. Not that I'm just talking to rappers and musicians and poets. And I'm talking to anybody who is participating in the creating and the cultivating of society.
Yeah.
And so you are making something, and you're making something is either going to contribute to the good or to the detriment of our society. And when you create for the detriment, guess what? You can repair. You can repent and you can repair. But even when you're creating for the good, don't feel like you're always in a fixed position, because sometimes society shifts and what you thought was good, it may change. And I'm not like teaching relativism, but the reality is there are things that yeah. change, societies change, ideas change, and you have to reevaluate. Like, is this most beneficial for society right now? Like, you know, political parties change. The political party that was the of Lincoln was the Liberating Party.
Right.
It's fair to say that that's probably not that party right now.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
How? All right. That's brilliant. Thank you. Final word. You know, if someone picks up, he saw that it was good. And I hope they do.
I hope they do too.
Yeah. If they pick up a copy of He Saw That It Was Good, what do you hope they come away with?
I think a lot of what I just shared, one, a new theology of each chapter kind of tries to approach good from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. So the first chapter talks about stories. So a theology of stories. I know in Christian spaces, we love to call a theology of something. It's like a theology of this.
Yeah. Right.
So just bear with me. I'm going to do that same thing. It's like a theology of story. What does it mean to tell good or bad stories? Then the second chapter is like a theology of work. What does it mean to see good work? Then the third is like, what is justice and how justice is tied through stories, work, and the history of Christian, especially more Black Christian posture. How they didn't have the luxury to detach this idea of justice from not only the cognitive faith they had, but the corporeal faith of liberation, of physical liberation. So then the next chapter I'll talk about, even if you have all of these positions, we're going to have differing opinions on how to execute justice. And that's okay, because throughout history, there's always been dissenting voices, even for good causes. How do we figure out how to work together, even in our difference, for what we see might be good? And then the next chapter is, okay, some of us are going to be in the palace. Some of us are going to be in the desert. Some people, and I use that analogy in a sense like, you know, minorities specifically, some of us will be in white evangelical institutions and some of us won't be. Does that mean that one person is more valuable than another? Or some people are sellouts and others aren't sellouts? Or like, how do we begin to see that no matter where God places us or no matter where we are, we can still do good work?
Yeah. Do we give room to others?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
And so then there's another chapter where I talk about our fear of the dark, our fear of engaging, because of how oftentimes we handle darkness with kitty gloves, because we're afraid that it's some sort of contagion that will get on us and we won't be able to think properly if you engage the world. Mm-hmm. But there is no secular sacred. God right. owns it all.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, basically I want people to learn that they are contributing to the developing of a good narrative, a good society, a good culture, but you can also be part of the problem.
We are, or we're not, but we're. Yes. But there's no middle ground.
Absolutely.
No middle ground.
So, whew.
Show Baraka. This has been informative. I'm going to put a bunch of links in the show notes because I want to link people to some of your albums.
Absolutely.
You know, and website, and all ways that folks can follow you on social media. Thank you for your time. Thank you for, I know writing a book is a labor of love because it's hard work for not much money.
So it is a lot of work. It is.
Yes,
definitely
it is.
That.
So thank you for He Saw That It Was Good, Reimagining Your Creative Life to Repair a Broken World. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Anita. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And to everyone else, as always, I say, keep the conversation going.